Wealth is power, and power is wealth. The aphorism commonly attributed to the Englishman Thomas Hobbes, author of the great political philosophical treatise Leviathan, 1651, was later invoked by Adam Smith in the greatest treatise ever written on commerce, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, 1776. Smith was a Scot, not an American, but up until 1776, Scots and Americans shared something in common. Both were subjects of the British Empire. In the age of commerce, empire and capitalism grew up together. For centuries, empires had long assessed their control over land, population, and taxable resources. In Europe, by the 18th century, commerce had become the most dynamic generator of imperial wealth and imperial power. How states might best promote commerce was Smith's focus in The Wealth of Nations, published the year the 13 North American colonies declared their independence from the British Empire. Smith said Britain might let the colonies go, arguing that what he called the mercantile system, the imperial policies that defined the commercial relationship between Great Britain and its colonies, against which the North American colonists were then revolting, did not promote the wealth of nations. Smith admired the commercial character of British North America, and today many consider him to be something like a patron saint of capitalism, as, supposedly, he was critical of all government intervention into the market. That was not so. Smith was a theorist of political economy, of the relationship between the ordering of power and the generation of wealth. He made no categorical separation between the political and the economic, or state and market. The question for him was their relationship and the consequences of their complicated overlap. The wealth of nations could be the result only of good policymaking. However, The Wealth of Nations does not begin with a policy analysis. Rather, Book One lays out Smith's explanation of economic commercialization. To understand the dynamics of pre-industrial capitalism, there is no better place to begin but here. Book One of The Wealth of Nations holds the key to explaining the development of American capitalism from 17th century English colonial settlement through the American Civil War, the era spanning the Age of Commerce. Smith explained how the self-interested pursuit of commercial gain, breeding more commerce, tends toward an increasing division of labor. When the extent of the market for goods expands on the demand side, spurred on by self-interest under the pressures of competition, producers specialize, and on the supply side, the division of labor increases. So, then, does labor productivity. The ongoing search for gains from trade induces more capital investment. In the cumulative process, economic activity brings increasing returns. Everyone may gain from trade. The wealth of nations grows. This is what economists today call Smithian growth, the combined and interactive result of self-interest, the division of labor, and the extent of markets. The analysis of commerce in Book One of The Wealth of Nations is of great explanatory power, but it is incomplete. For the North American colonies, as well as their commercial character, were conscious political creations in which politics and Smithian growth dynamically interacted. There was no capitalism in North America prior to the long-term British investment in imperial expansion. By force, states had to increase the extent of the market. The British project to do so was imperialist in character, of a mercantilist variety. Mercantilism had no fixed body of doctrine. Smith named his own enemy when he spoke of the mercantile system, as neither he nor anyone who came before him had used the term mercantilism. Nonetheless, during the 17th and 18th centuries, a common set of basic assumptions about the relationship between political and economic life held together that can usefully be labeled mercantilist. Foremost, mercantilists promoted an understanding of political economy in which there was no categorical separation between state and market. Smith inherited this legacy. But unlike Smith, mercantilists defined national economic prosperity as the existence of a positive balance of trade with other nations. Greater market access and more commerce were the sources of imperial wealth, but only when a nation exported goods of value greater than it imported, including in relation to its colonies. More coin flowed into the nation's coffers at the expense of its geopolitical competitors. Foreign trade produces riches, riches, power, power preserves our trade and religion, insisted East India Company Governor Josiah Child in 1681. Mercantilists took for granted a zero-sum global economy, occupied by warring states, forever fighting over market access abroad. Not all nations could gain from trade, not all at once. In this economic combat, because so much commerce was seaborne, as goods in this era moved far more economically over water than over land, overseas colonies could be of decisive commercial importance. After the English Civil War, the Restoration English state moved to incorporate its wayward early North American colonies into its expanding imperial mercantilist orbit. As it did, mercantilism transformed, and American capitalism was born.